So I typically don't start interviews this way, but I'm compelled to ask. Christopher and Gretel, how are your hearts today?
Broken.
Heavy.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Gretel Ehrlich and Christopher Merrill about the anthology Hearth, a global conversation on community, identity, and place. This interview was made possible by the Montana Book Festival and took place the afternoon of Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation. Stay with us.
In the preface of the book, Onyx Smith asks, why do we need a book about something so obvious and good? And what I want to know is, why do we need this book, and is it that obvious and good?
Well, I would say in tumultuous times, we think more and more about the nature of hearth, which can be a complicated place and a place of drama. And after this week's drama, I think many of us feel ever more the importance of drawing tight around in that circle around the hearth.
And I think it can also be just a campfire. My favorite place is, I love to cook, and my favorite place to cook is over an open fire where I stayed in Zimbabwe for several months with a great big grate. And we did everything around that fire. So that became sort of the center of our world, and also the center of feeding each other, and while terrible things were happening there as well.
And it became the place where you told the stories, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The book is composed of established and emerging writers from Scotland, Nigeria, Iceland, Dominican Republic, Vietnam, Singapore, America, Australia, Ireland, and Kenya. The poems in prose are filled with themes of the familial, geographical, ecological, spiritual and political, and as Deborah Magpie Erling states, the violence of survival. What do you see as the connections between survival, violence, and hearth?
That's a real simple question. Well, you know, I think in every situation, whether you're in your own house or on the road, as both Chris and I are often in far-flung places, that you find a place of sanctuary, and sometimes it has to be just inside yourself. And you have to sort of groom that place so that you know you can go there when, you know, guns are being pointed at you or it's psychological terror, as we've experienced the last few days in this country. Not terror, but, you know, just a very disheartening sense of the abrogation of justice. And what do you do in a world where there's no justice? And how do we find that inside ourselves and keep examining it? And so, of course, hearth. I had a wonderful house on the coast of California. It was a great big central fireplace with an enormous hearth, and we all just sat there. And it was there that you felt, as El Nino storms raged around you, that it was false comfort, but it was the comfort that you needed at the moment. And it is not falseness in a bad sense, but of, you know, ephemeral, that was short-lived. And so you just have to keep this in mind as you travel through history, as you travel the world, as you travel through your own interior disruptions, that there are hearths inside us and hearths outside, and if we create a space where we feel comfortable living, that you have to make that place to go to, so you can kind of get your stuff together and then go back out again.
And something that Gretel just said reminds me of something I didn't write about in this book, but when I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, I remember so many meals in Sarajevo, when it was under siege and there was no gas, water, or electricity, we ate by candlelight. And the thing that I take from so many of those meals was the sheer hilarity of the stories that people told, the jokes that people told. We find ways to make do even in circumstances that seem extreme, such as we might feel we're living through right now.
Yeah, and I think humor is sort of a hearth, a movable feast of
exactly.
A hearth. And yes, in war zones and in times of natural crises, it's always the humor that binds you and keeps you going.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be honest. When the book first came to me, I thought, oh, this is cute. Milkweed has put out a nice little book on community and place. And I set it to the side. And then I opened it and read Barry Lopez's foreword and immediately thought, oh, I can meet this book where it's at. And where he caught me was with a question that what underlies virtually all of the essays is, what is the hearth of the Anthropocene? What now is the symbol of our allegiance and our concern for the face of others, especially in the fate of the stranger? How naive. What do you see as the symbol of allegiance then?
Well, that's a good question.
You go first.
Well, I would say that W.S. Merwin once said to me when we were discussing the environmental crisis, if you're driving down the highway and you see a terrible accident, you don't think, I wonder if they're going to live or die. You get out and you try to help. And part of what Anik Smith and Susan O'Connor did in assembling this marvelous anthology is to give us ways to think about what we do when we get out to help. We don't know whether humankind will survive the dramatic rise in temperature that we are seeing right now. But even as we try to do everything we can to stave that off, we also must remain mindful of what it means to be a human being, and asking lots of different writers to meditate or reflect on the nature of hearth is a way to help us think about how we are in this world and what we will do to try to keep this world intact.
Well said. He said everything. I have nothing
fair
to
enough.
Add to that.
Fair enough. One of the other things I found interesting is the pairing of the Neolithic and this current moment. In Mark Tredinnick's essay, he pairs Google and God. And Bill McKibben, of course, writes about the tiny little screen hearths on our laps. The internet is now our collective hearth, he writes. We tilt toward the screen the way plants twist toward the sun. I don't have an answer for this, but I'm going to ask you, what might the alternatives be to this, you know, these little hearths of the Anthropocene, these little smartphones we have? What might we do differently?
You mean differently if that didn't exist?
Yeah. Or how could we turn away?
Do we want to turn away? I mean, I think there's two things for me that go on with the internet and et cetera, is that we, because of Google search engines, et cetera, we have access to complex scholarly papers. You know, you can find out all kinds of things that used to take weeks to get to a proper library. And, you know, it is really wonderful, especially for writers. But on the other hand, I think that the social networks that are going on give rise to this sense of being as opinionated and as disrespectful as possible. And that this sense that you're, I mean, it's really interesting because in the old days we talked about participatory democracy. Now we're finding out it really doesn't work in the sense where everybody can just say what they want and without a greater sense of the world or how things have to work. And we're seeing that in our own government right now, too. They're just this sort of self-imposed ignorance. And so there's two different things at work here. And I think people really need to think about what are the really important elements for human civilization? What's important? And how do we really need to interact with each other? And I think this book is really about, you know, the longing for community, which is what hearth basically represents, whether it's a community of you and your dog or a community of us sitting here and talking. So I think those are interesting things that we don't, you know, sort of like people say, no, you know, I never watch television. You know, I'm too good for that. Well, that's silly. No, you just take what you need of the modern world and you use it in a better way. And you what is not really working out, you say, no, we're not going to do that. Or at least I'm not going to do that anymore. You can't speak for everybody, but you know what I mean? So as always, as we're moving forward, we can't control what comes in and what goes out. And to do away with everything is sort of like becoming a museum piece. And we don't, you know, that's not how humans function. We're opportunists. We're, you know, we're like bears. We take what's around, and you just have to be conscientious of what you're taking into your life.
And remember that smartphones have only been around for a very short period of time. I can remember the very first time I saw somebody with what we would now call a cell phone, and we were stuck in an elevator, and it was ringing, and he was clearly going crazy because he couldn't answer it. This was in about 1989, and the elevator door opened, and he answered this huge phone and said, "What's happening, sports fan?" And I thought, oh, the world is changing. It's changed again. But it's just a few months ago, I found myself in Nanjing, China, and I was given the task of writing something very quickly, and I agreed to do it. It was for a conference, so I went to my hotel room and I started writing this piece, and then I, you know, just flipped to go to Google because I needed to look something up. That's how we write now. And I thought, oh, that's right, I can't get to Google in China. And my VPN doesn't work here. And so I had to fall back on older resources.
Right.
So in a way, you could say that what this book attempts to do is to remind us of those older sources of hearth, even as, ideally, it gives us a skill set to deal with all the coming changes, which we know will be profound, as they always are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Gretel Ehrlich and Christopher Merrill about the anthology Hearth, a global conversation on community, identity, and place. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook.
Before we dive into your individual pieces, I just want to ask one last question. On the cover of the book is a giant flame. And Gretel, both you and Jane Hirschfield, the poet, draw a parallel between hearth fire and ecology, namely forest fires and climate change. And I've been sitting with the contradiction of warmth. You know, it's necessary for survival and for community, and also it's been a destructive force and we've contributed. So what does warmth even mean?
On a day like this?
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Well, as we're speaking, there's a huge, huge wildfire in the part of Wyoming where I lived. And I just got a text from friends who were, you know, everybody I know is evacuated or evacuating. You know, one friend had to move her 2,000 head of mother cows and calves. I don't know. I said, where are you taking them? She said, just down the highway for right now. And of course, you know, one of the root causes of climate change is the desertification of the planet. And then you add to that the warming oceans, and you have a world that is heating up exponentially and causing, you know, all the storms and the screwed up jet stream, and it goes on and on. So in a way, you know, we got too much warmth,
right?
Too much warmth in our kind of carelessness, and I think that, you know, reading through all the essays in this book, that if everybody in the world looked for the kind of warmth that comes from hearth, I mean, the kind of warmth that's nourishing and that is shareable, which requires a kind of care and caring for what the world is made of and what the society of sentient beings is all about, then we wouldn't have the climate crisis that we're having. So So the hopefully the wildfires will instruct somebody. And also I find that as the world is kind of coming apart, the planet's sort of, the planet just doing its thing, but, you know, it's destroying our kind of sense of what it is, that it makes me cherish what's around me even more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what Merwin calls paying clear attention actually becomes an active part of one's daily practice of mm-hmm. being alive.
And I would just add to that one of the really beautiful essays in this book by Pico Iyer, My Mobile Home, comes in the wake of him losing all of his possessions, including all of his notebooks from his years of traveling as a writer in such a fire, and how he makes do in the new dispensation.
Christopher, would you share some of your lines with us?
Yeah. Maybe I'll just read the first part. I wrote a sort of poem in the long lines of Walt Whitman called Versets, Hearth. In certain dialects in northern England and in Scottish dialects, hearth still rhymes with earth. An obsolete meaning of the word is hearing, which in my mind connects heart to hearth, since it is in the nature of the imagination to find correspondences between one thing and another. For example, the only usable fireplace in our house on Prospect Street was in the renovated kitchen, the masonry in the older rooms having fallen into disrepair before we moved in, so we spent much of the winter in the kitchen with our young daughter. The Dutch oven installed by the last owners was for show, and yet some days I swore I could taste the soft pretzels delivered weekly to my Pennsylvania Dutch grandparents' house. After his last patient left in the evening, my grandfather, a country doctor and water dowser, would climb the steps from his basement office to sit with me in the kitchen, slathering mustard over the pretzels he washed down with a beer. His witch hazel divining rod in my hands revealed nothing until he placed his hands over mine, and then it dipped toward the ground, his muscles tensing as though he could not control the force issuing through his body. Here was my first and most enduring lesson in the art of courting poetic inspiration.
Yours, like a number of the other pieces, pulls from other literary sources. Why did you make this natural move to include Wordsworth?
Well, so much of what I do as a writer is a complete mystery to me. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, how the hell did I get to Wordsworth?
Right.
But I think that's the nature, in a way, I'm talking about inspiration. And the nature of any act of writing is to follow the impulses of the language. And Wordsworth has a poem about a water diviner, and that memory of my grandfather showing me how to douse for water, which even at a young age I thought was probably a crock, until mm-hmm. I felt the witch hazel twisting very hard in my hands. And then I thought there is a deeper kind of knowledge here that my grandfather, the healer, has some access to. And that impressed itself on my imagination at an early age.
You are the director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa and have served on the U.S. National Commissions for UNESCO. And you're also a translator. What do you know about international perspectives pulling their way into your understanding of hearth?
Well, that's what made it so much fun to receive the invitation from Anik and Susan to help advise this, to think about all the international writers I've had the good luck to host in our program. We've hosted about 1,500 writers from 150 countries over the last 50 years. And so I have the chance on a daily basis to talk with writers who have their own versions of what hearth is. And to take an example, the other night in Seattle, several of the writers were, what they were all talking about, what they missed in their time in the International Writing Program was their cooking at home. And it came down to a writer from Macedonia saying, your tomatoes in this country, they are nothing like our tomatoes in Macedonia. And I thought, now, this, she was really speaking from the heart. We remember the foods of our childhood. They anchor us in a place. And what we try to cultivate in the International Writing Program is respect for all these different ways of being in the world, all these different kinds of hearts that in one way or another bind us not only to one another but to the earth itself.
Mm. Gretel, I'm just going to have you jump in.
Okay.
And read a piece.
I'll just preface it by saying when Annika, who's an old friend, suggested that I write a piece, I was indignant. Are you kidding? Hearth? It's all burning down. It's all being covered with mud. It's all... So this is what I wrote.
All right.
No longer safe anywhere. I don't care if I live or die, nor would I act only for my own safety. But I would like to visit a favorite place, the water-stained revetment, the copse of aspens, the small river flowing through a valley of willows filled with moose and birds. I will walk there and stay for a while, my family of one, the Kelpie and me. I take off as soon as the half moon appears, clouds dissolve and Venus is rubbed bright. I walk on dead leaves and crumbling grass, a charnel ground of mashed up beauty, up and up, past a cluster of wild raspberries, the fruit all gone, past the waterfall. Heat has drained couloirs of their plugs of old snow. I climb up to the open plateaus above and lie on spent wildflowers, pillowing my head on pine boughs. When daylight comes, I sleep. There was no way to see when the dew arrived. It was just there, gift of the night air. I harvest it because there's no water elsewhere. When it's time to leave, I walk backward, a contrary clown, back, back, up, up, until on a ridge where bits of glacier ice remain, I gnaw at a chunk and swallow 10,000-year-old meltwater. Much later, maybe days or weeks, I descend. Welcome to the nightmare, the Kelpie barks in greeting.
When I read that first section, I was openly crying in a coffee shop.
Tears are good.
But these first four words, no longer safe anywhere.
That's how I feel.
Yes.
Yeah. I look at the world atlas and I think, well, no, can't go there. No, can't go there. No, that flood, fire, war, you know. And not that, and as I said, I'm not looking to save myself. I'm looking at what is now.
Yes.
And I think about everyone. How does anyone find a place to live, a hearth? Where is there a sense of the safety that we just, you know, took for granted in the interglacial paradise that we grew up in, and now that's gone?
Gretel, your piece struck me personally because I grew up in the interglacial paradise of Southeast Alaska. And so, you know, when I am deep in fire season in Northwest Montana, that's where my mind wants to go, where it still rains,
me too.
200 inches a year. And yet, it too is, you know, deeply in pain. And in your work, you circle grief and fury. And I'm just like, how do you process your own grief and fury day to day?
Well, it's like feast and famine. I mean, it's really, it comes, you know, all through the day, fury. And as I said, as I'm kind of harvesting the fragments of wildfire ash, you know, you catch a piece of ash and look at it and see how beautiful it is. So it's living on the charnel ground, so to speak, and also seeing how beautiful it is. So it's, you know, you're sort of going back and forth. I have no solution of how to live. I just, you know, whatever comes up, comes up.
But you have the constant of writing, too, to try to make some account about it, right?
Yes. Mm. Well, that's always been my habit, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And also, I go out, you know, I live outside a lot. I mean, when things get really bad, I go to the mountains and hike until I can't walk anymore, and I take off my boots and put them in the stream, if there is water in the stream, and limp back. And, you know, I just try to grind it out of myself. And then, you know, nourish myself with reading and thinking and listening to chamber music and walking and growing my vegetable garden. And, you know, you just keep, you know, things get cut away and you keep re-nourishing yourself.
Maybe two of my favorite lines come from your piece, from this whole book. One is, home is where there is no I. And the other would be, intimacy requires time. Time requires devotion. Devotion demands surrender. How do we balance surrender and fury, or surrender and action? Both seem really needed, but I can't quite wrap my head around it. So I don't know if either of you.
Well, I think what I meant by surrender is, you know, a broken heart is also an open heart.
Yes.
And so if you're open-hearted, and that doesn't mean you're nice or, you know, or that anything has been resolved or you're not furious, but you're also raw. It's that wonderful feeling of rawness and openness and vulnerability and humility and terror and all at once. And so you live in that, you know, sort of like as if your skin had been peeled off and you're just raw flesh. And so you actually feel everything. So your response to who you are and where you are, not who you are, but, you know, where you are in the world is very immediate and precise. And that which engenders a clearer way of seeing where you are and perhaps a better way of expressing it, you certainly don't have to be a writer, but whatever expression you choose of action, that action is devotion. It means, you know, I have to do something, whatever it is. And so you just have to take it all in, mm-hmm. at the same time. And, you know, and have the stability, which is embedded in all of us, whether we think it is or not, to hold all those contradictions in one hand.
Mm-hmm. I might say that brokenness demands that we pay attention both to the source of the grief and to the place where we find ourselves. And writers are people who tend to pay attention, and that's where so much of my writing comes from. And I think that's what governs a lot of the writing in this book.
Gretel Ehrlich is a travel writer, poet, essayist, and recipient of a Whiting Award and Guggenheim Fellowship. Christopher Merrill is a poet, essayist, journalist, and translator, currently serving as director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Look for more information about their work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bo Baker, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.